One in three women are affected around the world by intimate partner violence or domestic violence of some kind. That went to one in two during the pandemic, which is astonishing. And so this is why they called it a shadow pandemic.
Gender inequality is not news, but the more the issue is explored and analysed, the more concerning its depth and profundity. One area that's opening up alarmingly is the issue of women's health, how it's regarded, how lowly it's ranked, and the impact on health carers and women alike. One myth that my guest today aims to debunk is that women's health gets little attention. She argues instead, it's not getting the right attention. Few social scientists have done more to raise global awareness than Sophie Harman, Professor of International Politics at Queen Mary University of London. Not only the forces shaping women's healthcare globally, but the reforms needed to address the failings, inequalities, and injustices within the system. She's a world-leading authority on the politics of global health governance. Amongst many awards and accolades, she was awarded the prestigious Leverhulme Prize in 2018 in recognition of her achievements as a researcher. Her recent book, Sick of It, The Global Fight for Women's Health, published in 2024, and as an Observer columnist, I should add, then named Observer Book of the Week, explores both the global forces shaping women's health inequalities and the deeply personal, everyday experiences of women as patients, carers, and healthcare workers. 10 years ago, Sophie co-produced a feature film called Pilli with women living with HIV in rural Tanzania. The film received a BAFTA nomination and was used by the UN as part of a training toolkit. It generated thousands of pounds for the women in the film, a real example of social science in motion. Nor does it stop there. She's also played a prominent role in research and policy work around the COVID-19 pandemic, both in Britain and via the UN, again focusing on the women health issue. Sophie, welcome. What a record! I mean, let's start with the Sick of It. I mean, what got you writing that?
Do you know what? I can tell you the exact day in which I realised I wanted to write Sick of It. It was back in February 2020, and I was in Freetown in Sierra Leone, and I was walking into the Ministry of Health, and someone put a temperature gun to my head and asked me to wash my hands, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's happening again. Because previously I'd done lots of research on Ebola and how it impacted on women's lives, how women as frontline healthcare workers were disproportionately affected, how more women died of pregnancy-related complications than Ebola. And at the time I thought, gosh, COVID-19 is here, it's happening, women somewhere are going to be affected. And we don't know where that's going to happen, but we know that we've learned about this and my research has shown that. But I had this deep sense of dread of, is anyone paying attention to this? Is anyone paying attention to what's happening with women in health emergencies? And so the more I thought about it, the more I was reflecting on what was happening in the world, about how lots of leaders around the world had said they wanted to halve maternal mortality, yet still there was very little progress. And the more I thought about it, the more I just thought, gosh, this isn't an issue of science. This is an issue of politics. And it's a politics where it's not that women are ignored. They actually get quite a lot of attention in international relations. Yet, here I am again, in a country like Sierra Leone, seeing another health emergency on the horizon. And yet it felt like we hadn't learned the lessons of Ebola back in 2014 and 16.
Now, you're a professor of international politics, and your work is almost entirely focused on women's healthcare. You know, I think both are great, but it's not obvious you get from one to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear that a lot, actually. And I think a lot of the time, there's a lot of work that's been done, particularly recently after Me Too, around women's health and the neglect of women in healthcare and science research. And that has been fantastic and really important. But a conclusion that's often met is that it's the politics that's the problem. And that politics needs fixing in some kind of way. But no one really entangles what that politics is. And so I see that that's my role in this, to actually say, well, it's not just the science, it's the politics, and it's a global politics that's the problem. And so when people say, well, what's women's health got to do with international relations? Actually, quite a bit. So if you look at, say, Donald Trump, a big part of Donald Trump's constituency is MAHA mums, so Make America Healthy Again mums, who really support RFK Jr. and therefore led their support to Trump. So that's one area. But in the book...
I'm not sure everyone knows that in Britain, actually.
Oh, don't they? Okay.
I mean, we know about RFK.
Yeah.
But not about this movement. Well, this has got mothers...
Make America Healthy Again Mums.
Make America Healthy Again Mums.
Yeah, MAHA Mums.
MAHA Mums. And yeah. they are a subplot within the MAGA movement, aren't they?
They are. But they were sort of independent of the MAGA movement originally. So they really are concerned around pesticides, big pharma. And I'm interested in them because for years they felt that their health needs and those of their children were neglected. So they started to look at alternative medicines and alternative lifestyle habits to address some of these concerns. And then RFK Jr. comes along, he starts speaking their language, and they become this real political constituency within the US.
Your focus on healthcare workers is kind of a consistent theme. I mean, they're going to be the ones disproportionately hurt by Ebola, but here in the UK, they're the ones that are particularly badly hit by COVID. Mm-hmm. And actually, when there's a crisis in maternity services, it's mainly women maternity workers. Mm-hmm. So
when we start to think about how women's health is exploited as an issue in global politics, there's two ways. It's the issue of women's health, but it's also the workers in the health sector. So as we know, 75% of healthcare workers around the world are women. And this doesn't even account for the informal healthcare workers. So everyday community healthcare workers who will be providing basic provision like food or changing the bed linen of sick people in their communities, or even people in the UK that organise to look after their neighbourhoods or cared for the elderly who couldn't leave the house, for example. So we have this huge burden upon women in the health sector. They tend to be lower paid as well, particularly at the community health worker end. But there's a dichotomy here, because even though the majority of healthcare workers in the world are women, the leaders of healthcare tend to be men. And we've had some high profile women. So Melinda French Gates is probably the most biggest example, huge philanthropist. She is the ex-wife of Bill Gates. And with Bill Gates, they founded the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which up until recently was the second largest donor to international aid for health after the US government. So it's now the biggest. And she is hugely influential, but she is just one, right? So we have these highly influential women. But really, when we look at who runs health, it's men, and it's men making these decisions.
Just as I'm reflecting on that, does that naturally mean that certain issues get neglected and others get prioritised because kind of men are allocating resources? I mean, presumably there's a kind of toolkit in which they have to kind of follow about where resource should go. I mean, I'm just, you know, just, you think it's gendered, you think even that's gendered?
Absolutely. I think if you take something like health emergencies and pandemic prevention, we have now a good deal of research that shows that women are disproportionately affected by health emergencies. Yet the men that make the decisions around how to respond to health emergencies in the World Health Organization, in the World Bank, all these kind of organizations, being men, they completely ignore these issues. And the only time they ever speak about these issues, they say, well, we might need better gender representation on some of our decisions.
When you say ignore, what does that mean in terms of experience on the ground?
Experience on the ground. Yes, yeah, so they're ignoring what's happening to them. So when you say ignore, if you say something like, how do you prepare for the next pandemic, right? What are the things you put in place? So first, it's identifying when there's an outbreak, all that type of thing. But when you respond to a pandemic, what you firstly need to do is you need to obviously track and trace of who is being affected. So you need to know if men or women are affected more, as well as other ethnicities within this. So track and trace and then disaggregating that data is really important. That didn't used to happen. It happens now, but back in Ebola in 2014-16, they didn't look disaggregate for gender or ethnicity. We see that happening more, which I think is a positive. Secondly, you want to protect your healthcare workers. And to protect your healthcare workers, you need to pay them on time to make sure they're showing up to work. But you also need to give them appropriate personal protective equipment, what we all know as PPE, right, from COVID-19. Most PPE is made to fit the average man. How is it that we are creating PPE to fit the average man when the average healthcare worker is a woman? That's just madness. The other thing to think about is when you have pandemic response measures such as lockdowns or quarantines. We knew from back in 2014 that during quarantines, if you have a lockdown, the domestic and intimate partner violence goes up. Yet with COVID-19, no one thought about this in the first months of lockdown. It was something that came a bit later. And people like me and some of my colleagues were really doing a lot of work around this with women's groups to try and elevate this issue as well.
It's not enough on people's kind of radar.
Yeah.
The amount of domestic violence, the amount of women suffering homicides at the hands of men. Mm. I mean, it's certainly in a kind of male radar. And this is obviously going to increase in a lockdown, obviously increase in any kind of response to a health crisis, which demands some degree of isolation. Mm. I mean, it's a huge thing, actually. I mean, you're talking about in any population, the number of women possibly being killed increasing by 1x or 2x. And it's incredible.
Yeah, the UN called it a shadow pandemic. So UN women were doing research to try and quantify what was happening. And I think they said it was 1 in 3 women are affected around the world by intimate partner violence or domestic violence of some kind. And I think they said that went to 1 in 2 during the pandemic, which is astonishing. And so this is why they called it a shadow pandemic.
Hmm. Yeah. So I get it. I mean, your thesis is, and it's not a thesis, it's supported by data, that this is not sufficiently on decision makers' radar. Is directly related to their gender.
Mm. I think it's improving. So I think if you look at the current Ebola outbreak in the DRC and Uganda, you are seeing some awareness of this. You see people actually talking about the kind of how women and girls are affected. I was watching Channel 4 News the other day and they actually mentioned it. But mentioning something doesn't mean something's being done about it. But I think awareness has improved. And I think that is a positive. And that is because of all the research that's been going on around it, particularly within the social sciences.
Is this why you think that women's health is moving up in terms of political salience?
Mm.
I mean, you think that, you know, is that a... I mean, you talked about Channel 4 News, but I mean, is your work having kind of... Do you get resonance from your work? I mean...
Yeah, I think so. I think you're seeing much more attention to women's health. I think that is possibly because of the work that I do, but also other colleagues in really bringing this work to the fore. There's been a lot of advocacy around women's health. So there's more research that's gone into it. And I think we really have to thank the work of people like Caroline Criado Perez and Invisible Women. Her book, I think, was a huge catalyst. You also see more women.
Not many people will know about this book. I mean, I just think that, I mean, she was the writer who kind of exposed this extraordinary, I mean, amongst many other things, that actually in car accidents, it's the male body which gets tested and not the female body.
Yeah.
I had a friend of mine who was directly kind of suffering, but that's a consequence of that, actually. And much more.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book, Invisible Women, was a real game changer because there was a lot of kind of academic research around the absence of women from clinical trials, for example. And Criado Perez just brought all this research together in this best-selling book in a really accessible way that also, it was a great advocacy tool because people could then take this research and go to the science bodies or funders and say, look at what you've been doing. And you saw a sort of change in attitude, I think, in how funders of research were thinking about the problem. And I think that's why you see some of those advances in science in this kind of way. I think you also had some really great leaders. So here in the UK, you know, leaders of the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists are really trying to respond to these kind of issues. So you do see more awareness, but I think that's also allowed women to find their voice and saying, right, we are not going to suffer in silence. We expect better treatment. I think data is also a big issue here. Now, I have a mixed relationship with data. I'm not a big fan of data, and we can kind of talk about that. But if you look at something like Black maternal mortality, so Black women in the UK, their communities, families and friends knew what was happening, right? They knew that they weren't being taken seriously, their pain wasn't being taken seriously, or they would lose a loved one through very routine healthcare, such as giving birth, right? And it wasn't until there was a study that came out with the data in this top line of that black women are 5 times more likely to die from pregnancy and childbirth related complications than white women in the UK. 5 times more. That's what the data gave you. That data then gave you a kind of activism or advocacy strapline, but also gave numbers to this experience and phenomenon that black women had been facing.
It seems such an impossibly high figure. I mean, why would it be so high?
It's terrible, isn't it? I mean, it's now gone down. I think it's now 3 times more in the latest study, but that's still horrific, right? So it's a mixture of things. So obviously, when we talk about black maternal mortality around the world, most people say, oh, well, it's an intersection between poverty and race.
But it's a global number. Yeah.
No, it's not a global number. The 5 times more is a UK number, but black maternal mortality tends to be higher in the world. But people will say, oh, that's because of this intersection between poverty and race. Whereas in the UK, that doesn't count because obviously we have the NHS, which should be free at the point of access. So it has to be something to do with race. And this is where you see a relationship between how women are believed, how black women are believed when they experience pain by the health services, and whether when they advocate for need, when they need an intervention or they say that they're in pain, they are not believed. And so there's a lot of education happening now within maternity health services around race to deal with this issue. And you have seen this number coming down much more.
Is it as simple as that? Seems like kind of that seems to be a... obviously one component.
It is one component, but I think it's a really important component around this. If you look at, so in the book I talk about, it's not the UK, but I talk about the case of Serena Williams. Now, I'm just going to assume you agree with me that Serena Williams is the greatest tennis player of all time, because there'll be no argument there. But when she gave birth, she felt that there was something wrong and she asked for an intervention and she wasn't believed. Now, Serena Williams, like, you know, that's a woman who is not scared of advocating for herself. And she eventually persevered and she had the intervention that she needed. But afterwards, she wrote about it. And she wrote about it as part of this legacy of black women not being believed when they're in pain or when they advocate for themselves. So this is a global phenomenon.
We'd like to tell you about another podcast from our friends over at The Conversation. They're a not-for-profit news and analysis platform pairing academics with journalists on every story. In their podcast, The Conversation Weekly, host Gemma Ware sits down with an academic expert every week to discuss a topic in the news to understand how we got here. From global politics to the latest scientific breakthroughs or the big dilemmas facing our planet, they talk to experts from all over the world who draw on years of research knowledge to pull out what really matters so that you can understand the context without the spin. New episodes of The Conversation Weekly land every Thursday. Find them wherever you get your podcasts. I think it's important to say, since how I read your book, is that it's not, I mean, there's a kind of suite of women's health issues that I think have raised in salience. Mm. I mean, the menopause, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But your point is that that's the tip of an iceberg. I mean, you're saying it's much, much, much more than that.
Yeah. And I think also, so the whole book is obviously about how women's health is used to gain political power. And I think it's bigger than this in that it's not just about curtailing women's health. What I think is really revealing is how women's health is used by people who actually advocate for women's health. So, for example, one thing I'm really interested in the book is this phenomenon of health washing. So I start the book talking about Rwanda. Now, when I talk about Rwanda, most people think about the 1994 genocide. For me, working in women's health, I think about the transformation of the health system after the genocide, led by this phenomenal woman called Agnes Binagwaahu. So they saw a huge transformation in women's health. They improved maternal health outcomes, vaccine uptake, HIV treatment, phenomenal. So much so that other African countries get sent to Rwanda to learn how to do women's health. They even have a university, the University of Global Health Equity, that also has specialist programs on not only women's health, but women's health leaders. So it's like a utopia. Everyone always says, what's the good model? Rwanda. But Rwanda is very savvy because in the global health world, Rwanda is like this donor darling. But in my other world of international relations, Rwanda is an authoritarian regime that murders its political opponents in South Africa and is on the record saying, yes, we did do that. When people talk about that, they use women's health to wash that reputation. And so Rwanda says, OK, you're calling me, you know, someone like Paul Kagame, the leader of Rwanda, would say, OK, well, you know, you're criticising what we do, but look at our phenomenal outcomes in women's health. So he uses it to wash the reputation of Rwanda and also expand its reputation in diplomacy, which is really effective. This is how women's health is effective. It can get you onto the world stage to say, look, we're a world leader, keep your foreign aid flowing, and we're someone you can do business with. It's so effective, I'm surprised more states don't do it.
So beware health washing, as you said.
Oh, absolutely.
An 18-minute feature film, Pili, in Tanzania,
yeah.
Women who suffer from HIV, living with it and how they manage it and get out of the dilemmas and ostracism that actually they face. The We Society, you know, I sit here opposite a whole bunch of people over the last 11 seasons. There's not many who can claim that. And it's raise sufficient money to kind of help the women themselves, I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So the whole idea to make a film came from this idea that I'd been working in Tanzania for a long time, for about 10 years at that point. And my career was going great guns. You know, I was talking to really interesting people like yourself and I was getting published. And I thought, But then I was really sort of struck that these women that I was encountering, or women in the communities in Tanzania I was working with, they know so much, and yet they don't get to represent themselves or express their own stories. So I was really interested in thinking about research methods that could bring them into the process to have them tell their stories and represent those stories. And that's where the idea for the film came from. And then I was really clear that when we made the film, I didn't know if it was going to make any money. I thought it was going to make a really, like, short academic
film. It got a BAFTA award, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Well, nomination. But I feel like we kind of won it through the attention that we got, so we'll accept that. We just thought it was just going to be a small film that I was going to make my students watch. I didn't think it would take off as well as it did. And that was just thanks to the women in the film, the phenomenal team that I was working with. So director Leanne Wellham, our cinematographer Craig Dean Devine, who made it look gorgeous. We just exceeded our expectations, and that's how it made the money for the women. So I was always really clear that any profit, it would just go straight back to the women in the film.
Now, how much, let me talk about that for a second. I mean, HIV in Tanzania, I mean, rural Tanzania, again, I mean, it's kind of remote from a studio in kind of near Borough High Street in South London. But I mean, you lived there.
Yeah, so I did as part of my PhD. So my PhD was on the World Bank, and it was looking at the World Bank and civil society relations. And this is way back in the early 2000s. And if you remember, it was the whole make poverty history.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was really, you know, I was coming from an international political economy background. I was looking at these institutions. And I landed in Tanzania, and I was really fortunate that lots of people wanted to talk to me. And they pointed out I would never know what aid agencies were doing just sat in a capital city. I would have to go to the kind of rural hospitals and rural areas to try and work out what was going on. And through doing this, that's how I established these relationships with these communities. And coming back to a care and treatment centre in Miono, which is where the film
how big
set.
I mean, you can suppress HIV, contain it. Its impact on women's health in Tanzania, how does that manifest itself?
Yeah, so obviously you can have antiretroviral treatment for people living with HIV. And thanks to it was the US government, it was George W. Bush with his President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, that changed the game for women in Tanzania. You know, you could get treatment for free. Okay.
And that's gone now.
Well, that's an interesting one. There's threats of it going. So we keep having bridging periods where the US says, well, we'll keep the funding going to a certain period. But the US government is trying to have new deals where they extract data from these countries. And so these are going through some of the courts of these countries. It's a bit technical.
Okay.
But yes, it's under threat, significantly under threat, I would say. But even though you had all this money for treatment, and you saw this kind of revolution happening off the back of this funding, people still stigmatised, and people were still stigmatising each other. But what I really found with Pili is how self-stigma was a big issue. So it wasn't just other people saying, oh, you're living with HIV, you brought it on yourself. It was people themselves thinking, I've got HIV, I need to keep this a secret, I can't live positively and freely, I want to go to a clinic in a different town rather than where it's available here. And that was huge in the communities I was working with.
Well, we've got to watch Pilly.
Great.
Earlier on, you said you were a data skeptic. That's a big thing for a social scientist to say.
I know it is, isn't it? I do love data. I'm not against data, but particularly in global health, that if quantitative data is king. So nothing exists or nothing happens unless you have the numbers. So if you look at, for example, start of COVID-19, research that I was doing that I had done on Ebola, I said, look, this is all the things that are going to happen to women. And everyone said, where are the numbers? I was like, well, we don't know the numbers because COVID-19 is happening at the moment. So with colleagues, we did do some real-time research to try and get that data. But without the numbers, no one would believe me. So unless, you know, if I said X amount of women are going to be affected by this, no one would believe you. And so it's about valuing the diversity of social science types of data, not just quantitative numbers, I think. My other concern with data is who owns data. Now, of course, as social science researchers, we have, you know, open access data. We have restrictions on how we use our data. When we get data, we inform people how we're going to use it. But as a women's health researcher, I'm really concerned about the amount of data we're giving tech companies for free through our apps. So period tracking apps, fertility apps. We just scroll these, we say yes with the consent without even thinking about it. But that data is pretty powerful.
And you were saying earlier that one of the issues for the ongoing supply of this kind of HIV treatment in Tanzania is actually a willingness by the Tanzanian government to cede the data to American data companies, I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a really big issue. So the US government says that they will have a health strategy. And as part of their health strategy, particularly African countries have to sign away the data of their populations, the health data. So the American government can sell that or give it to third-party American companies. And understandably, some governments are saying no, but it's a bit of having governments over a barrel. And this is a big issue actually in Kenya. So this went to court in Kenya and they blocked the signing of this agreement. And some groups, so some HIV communities were really up in arms because they were like, you just need to sign this deal because otherwise we're going to lose treatment. But other groups who are really concerned about human rights and data issues were like, absolutely, the government cannot sell this deal. So the US is like, well, this isn't our business. You want our money? Do it. These are the terms. And they've created a real contestation within these states.
Sierra Leone, Kenya, legal cases on data, HIV in Tanzania, Ebola, the kind of differential impact on women's homicide rates in periods of lockdown. I mean, it's been great, very interesting stuff and really raising the salience of some important issues. But I mean, what's going on right now in women's health? Are things getting better? I mean, what would you say?
I think it's a mixed story. I think obviously there are concerns with what the feminist movement calls backlash around sexual and reproductive rights, particularly with the rise of the global far rights that talk about traditional family values, which tends to be a dog whistle for reversing sexual and reproductive health. Obviously, the US aid cuts, that's a big issue. They're biggest funder in global health. That's very concerning. And we have now another health emergency of another Ebola outbreak. But, and I really want to finish with this, there is a sense of optimism, both because of the attention that women's health is getting now and the activism in the space. There is huge activism defending women's health, defending sexual and reproductive health rights for all, not just women, for men as well. And I think that's very vibrant and hugely active. And within that space, no one is waiting for governments to come to the rescue. No one thinks that a politician is going to come and save them. And so when you see all this happening in world affairs, it can be easy to think, you know, not just the kind of issues I mentioned, but say a targeting of a maternity hospital in war. It's easy to become despondent. But I think that movement of disgust around what's happening in women's health is quite powerful.
We have to stop.
Well, thank you
very much. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.